From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. To the question when, California's governor says he can't give a specific answer, that there's no light switch, no date when the state just opens back up again. But COVID-19 testing, which is one of the roadmap criteria, has gone, he says, from 2,000 people per day in March, now to 16,000 tests per day, with a goal of 60 to 80,000 for phase one of the reopening. But California could do even more.
Our entire PCR test, that's the swab-based test capacity, the instruments that exist in the state of California, if 100% were at full throttle and everybody was being tested because we had all the supply chains intact and ready to go, be about 95,000 tests we can conduct.
95,000 tests per day. Not yet, though. Of the state's core 251 sites, the governor says more than half need more swabs and other components. Just before the noon press conference yesterday, the governor said he talked about this with President Trump.
And the president secured and gave me the confidence that we will receive just this week a minimum of 100,000 swabs. That's the ability to collect 100,000 specimen samples. That will be forthcoming to the state of California this week. He said then we will be provided 250,000 swabs next week. And he said third week, expect to see a substantial increase above the 250,000.
So that's the swab update. Meanwhile, California is opening 86 new test sites in areas that are considered testing deserts. These are areas the governor described as socioeconomically challenged, many black and brown and rural areas, he said. And he added that California doesn't want to leave any communities behind in testing. Besides those 86 sites, more are opening. A drive-through location is being added in Fairfield at the Solano County Clinic on Courage Drive. Solano County, you might remember, was the location of the first identified case of community transmission in the country. And the county's public health director, Dr. Bila Matias, is on the phone. Dr. Matias, you have been a very busy person over the last 6 to 8 weeks, so I'm really glad we're able to have you with us on Insight today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to join, Beth.
Will you tell me what your view is of this ramping up of the testing?
Well, I do think that it's necessary for there to be more testing available. I think that most of the public health officials throughout the country have been echoing for a very long time that we have access to insufficient testing. Apart from the fact that there are many people who would like to be tested, there are many, many people we still have to turn away who are symptomatic, who would be appropriate to test were there enough test kits available. And it's also difficult when we have a cluster or the risk of an outbreak in a high-risk setting where we would want to test a lot of people. The shortages with swabs, the shortages with reagents, the shortages with access to testing locally have been a barrier. And I think that that's not unique to Solano. I think that's true throughout much of the country.
But some people might think Solano was on the map with more of a highlight because of that first case of transmission. Are you one of these backbone 251 test sites the governor mentioned? Is there any particular influx of supplies or attention you've been able to get because you did have this case?
Well, so we are part of the backbone, but sadly, no. It hasn't done us. It hasn't given us any advantage to have been involved with that first case or with the first hospital-based outbreak. There are a lot of communities around us that have been struggling to get access to test kits, ourselves included. So really what we've been doing is the best that we can with the little that we have. We've had to prioritize testing. We've tried to make sure that we prioritize high-risk individuals and those who are hospitalized and have put especially strong attention on long-term care facilities and other congregate facilities that house the fragile, and the fragile elderly. But no, I would say that it hasn't helped us at all. But at the same time, I don't think it's appropriate to suggest we're not doing the best that we can.
How many test locations do you have in the county? And I did mention that you have just added one this week. And I guess the more important question is how many people are being tested every day or every week, whichever measure is more appropriate for your county?
Well, so all five of our hospitals are able to obtain specimens for testing, as well as the local public health laboratory, and then we do have the local drive-through. So we have a little over half a dozen sites where we're able to actually obtain specimens for testing. All of our clinics can obtain specimens as well, but those tests all end up going to the commercial sector, which until recently has had relatively slow turnaround, but that has definitely improved. The number of tests being performed on average in Solano County daily runs between 50 and 75 per day. And I would suggest that that's far, far lower than we would like it to be, and far, far lower than our community would like it to be.
What's the latest number of positive cases in your county? And when I look online, I see that the county has had 3 deaths, but I'm not sure how current that number is.
The 3 deaths is accurate through yesterday. We are evaluating a 4th death today that may be related to it, so it's possible that our number will rise to 4, and we've had just over 180 confirmed cases.
So the second drive-through location, I want to be clear about this because some drive-through locations require registration on this website, Project Baseline. It looks like perhaps yours requires a check-in at the phone number. So can we go into some specifics? Because there's still a step that has to be taken before someone can be tested.
That's accurate. People can't just drive up. In our case, they need to contact us at that phone number, and then we'll schedule them for an appointment. So in the process, either the online approach or the telephone approach, we screen people to make sure that they have signs and symptoms that are consistent with COVID-19 in order to make sure that they are appropriate for testing. And that's because we still have significant limitations on our testing, so we want to make sure we're testing those people who are most appropriate.
I do want to be able to give the phone number. I'll give you a chance to make sure you have it in front of me. But who
I'm
are
you? I need a second to find it. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. I do also want to highlight who you're prioritizing right now, because I think anybody who's experiencing strong symptoms or is in a high risk group is a given. Is there more to say about the priority for testing?
Well, I think that those are definitely the people we most focus on. The highest priority groups are those that are hospitalized with consistent symptoms, those who are people who work in high-risk occupations, and that obviously includes healthcare, public safety, people who work in congregate facilities. Those people who are over the age of 65 would certainly be on our list as well. And then in addition to that, people with underlying health conditions. The problem that we face is that we simply don't have enough information or enough testing available to meet even those combinations. And so we do, unfortunately, still do have to prioritize. And there are people with milder symptoms that we're not going to be able to provide testing for, even though under optimum conditions, we certainly would want to.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Bila Matias. He's the public health director of Solano County. All week, Dr. Matias, I've had a variety of conversations approaching this testing topic from a variety of angles. It all comes back to a shortage of supplies. And I wonder on what level how we help people if we're just saying, we're short on testing, we're waiting, it's not here yet, but just keep taking care of yourself and keep reaching out if you get sick. The end of the week of a lot of these conversations, I'm left kind of wondering are how much public service this is.
Well, to be fair, again, we have to be practical in these situations. If we aren't able to test people and they have symptoms that are consistent with COVID, then we recommend isolation just as we would if they were positive. So we're making assumptions that they're ill because they have COVID rather than one of the many other causes. It is helpful to note that in our drive-through testing, only about 9% of people with symptoms have been positive for COVID, which means that the vast majority of people with these symptoms are ill from other respiratory diseases that are still circulating in our community. So when we make the assumption that it's COVID, that's a very conservative assumption. And we recommend to people that they need to stay in their home isolated, or if they can't, then in an alternate location, isolated until the appropriate amount of time has passed from the onset of their symptoms. And then we also have to talk about quarantining their family members. So there is an impact that happens when a person is judged to be positive. And if we're judging everyone to be positive because we don't have testing available to rule that out, then more people are being impacted than would otherwise be the case.
Thank you. I think that is some important information. Are you still recommending the length of 14 days as a quarantine in doubt?
For quarantine, it's 14 days from the last exposure. For isolation, we're going with the CDC's guidelines right now, which is essentially 7 days from the onset of symptoms, but making sure that all the symptoms have resolved. And so the problem with isolation at home is that if you continue to have contact with your family, then their 14-day quarantine doesn't start till the end of your isolation. Whereas if you can actually isolate effectively, then their quarantine can start sooner and their return to their normal activities can return sooner. Another point to keep in mind is that at least in the case of those people who are non-essential or who are able to work from home, quarantine has been much less of an issue since the stay-at-home orders have been in place than it was prior to that or will be following that. Because a lot of people are essentially quarantining anyway, because of the restrictions on movements that we have in throughout the state of California.
Right. Will you be antibody testing at any of the locations in the county?
We're definitely trying to acquire antibody testing for our public health laboratory so that we can use it to assess high-risk environments. So, for example, if we were to have a case occur in a long-term care facility, we would want to antibody test everyone in that facility so that we can get some sense of the degree of protection. And it's sort of in an ongoing manner going forward, public safety, healthcare, long-term care facilities, jails and prisons are places where it would be really good to know how much protection the workforce has. So, yes, we do intend to acquire it and use it for public health purposes. And then in parallel, we fully anticipate that the hospitals will utilize it heavily through the commercial sector. And it is slowly becoming available in the commercial sector, so more and more people will be able to be tested. There is a caveat, though, that we have to remind people about. Even if you are showing evidence of antibodies, we don't know yet how much protection that affords you. We don't know if you get, multiple years of immunity or just a few weeks, because viruses vary tremendously in that regard. And the other point to remember is it doesn't matter whether you have antibody or not. If you have an overwhelming exposure to the virus, you're going to get sick anyway. So it's important to remind people of what it means to have positive antibodies, and it's definitely not a panacea. It's not a situation where you can move around with impunity.
Let's go back then to that first case of community transmission. The patient was very sick, had been transferred to UC Davis Medical Center in Sacramento, but she's home, she's recovering. What else can you tell us about her recovery?
Well, her recovery has been slow because her illness was very severe. And those people who are hospitalized, in particular those who need ICU care and ventilator care, can have a pretty rocky road to their recovery and can be ill for a pretty prolonged period of time. So this disease, just like influenza and many other serious respiratory illnesses, when it gets to the point of being serious enough to require hospitalization, is something you need to take very seriously because the health impacts can be significant. And, it's not lost on any of us that as a person's illness is more severe, their risk of death increases. So that, the risk of death for people who need ventilators is very, very high. And the goal, obviously, is prevention because that minimizes that occurrence and that sequence of risks.
Will she fully recover from this?
I think the best guessing out there is yes, that the illness is acute, the damage is what the damage is, and if there is residual damage to someone's lungs or kidneys or some other organ, unfortunately that persists. But this doesn't show any evidence of being a chronic illness in the sense that it persists within your body. So your body does recover, and then unfortunately, if there is damage to organs, that remains residual. But most people are not going to have that. Most people are going to have a complete recovery.
Was there a key medication, one of the therapies that we're hearing about, that did in fact help save her life?
Well, she was one of the patients who was able early to get on to one of the many trials that were ongoing at the outset of this outbreak, and she may very, very well have had benefit from that. We certainly hope that's the case, because finding treatment at this point is critical in order to help especially those who become hospitalized with this illness. And she is part of one of the trials. The results have not yet been reported on any of those. And I think that we're all definitely waiting anxiously to be able to find out if the med that she was on or one of the other ones has actually shown efficacy.
Can you confirm whether this was remdesivir, which I know has
been
used?
In her case, it was remdesivir. Yeah, yes.
Okay.
But there are other trials underway as well. But that particular one was what she was able to avail herself of.
And putting the puzzle together backwards, have you learned more about how she might have become exposed?
Yes, our best guess at this point is that it was to a client in her workplace, and that it was a person who was not showing any obvious signs of illness. That's really the only place that we can identify the potential exposure for her. She was the first case in her family. She was the first case in her workplace, so that she would have been the one who provided was the source of risk to the others, which means that she was the first one to acquire it. And the only location that makes sense would have been her workplace, since the home was the only other place that she would have been, and she was the first one in her home to become symptomatic. So the best guess at this point is that it was a non-symptomatic client.
Hmm. Was it an office setting workplace?
Well, I'm not actually comfortable talking about the specific setting. You know, it was a small workplace setting involving interaction with the public directly. But I think it's also become quite clear, given the information most recently released by Santa Clara County, that this disease has been present in our community for many, many months before we thought that it was here. The initial conversation was focused on the disease having arrived in the U.S. in California and Washington in late January, early February. But it's really quite clear that we had exposures occurring well before that. And while we don't have any way of proving it, it certainly makes a lot of sense that we had illnesses circulating in our communities very shortly after they began circulating in China. And that goes back to September, October. There was uncontrolled exposure to people going back and forth by the tens of thousands every week over many, many months. So it's almost impossible to believe that we didn't have introduction of this virus into our communities late last year. So there was plenty of time for it to be circulating in our community for her to have become exposed to it.
Hmm. Dr. Matias, one more question. I'd like your thoughts about the reopening discussion that's going on, and with the backdrop of what might happen with the virus this fall, can you kind of wrap up your overview for us?
Well, the virus is impacting the U.S. right now in its first wave, and it is unlikely that it will have infected enough people so that we have genuine herd immunity across our communities, which means that in all likelihood it will return in the cold and flu season. So we anticipate that it may wane over the next couple of months and slowly dissipate, but then in all likelihood will return in the fall, probably the late fall or early winter, along with influenza and the other respiratory diseases that typically come during that time period. And so we're going to have to deal with it for another season with relative intensity, because there will still be so many people that are susceptible to it in that second wave. By the time a third wave occurs in late 2021, our hope is that there will be vaccine available, which can significantly blunt its impact. But I think it would be really foolish of us not to expect it to return in the fall or in the early winter. And so we do need to have some serious thinking about how we want to deal with it in that second wave. This first wave has been weathered relatively well here in the Bay Area, in California as a whole, not quite as well in some of the other larger cities like New York. So we know what it's capable of doing, and we're very fortunate that we've been able to have as attenuated a course of the outbreak here as we have had. But unfortunately, that also means that more people remain susceptible. And so a second wave is almost inevitable, and is something that we have to take seriously.
All right. Did you find that phone number?
I did.
All right.
Did.
Let's go.
So for those people who are Solano County residents or work in Solano County, the number to call for our drive-through testing is area code 707-784-8655. 707-784-8655.
All right. We'll post it on our website, as well as a link to more information about what's happening in the county with COVID-19 and your resources. I appreciate this conversation. I'm sure we have covered every topic you're asked about. If you have a final thought that you want to share with everybody at this point, please do.
I just want to suggest that, we've been going through a very unprecedented time with exceptionally difficult impacts that are in all likelihood inequitably distributed. And, as a community, we have weathered this storm to date, I think, as well as we possibly could. We're not out of the woods yet, but there is light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that we just need to stay strong to get through it, so that we can then recover as quickly as possible.
Dr. Matthias, thanks again for your time and all the information.
Thank you very much, Beth. I appreciate the interview.
That's Dr. Bela Matthias. He's the public health director of Solano County. Before talking about testing yesterday, Governor Newsom did announce that California healthcare systems across the state would begin returning to surgeries and procedures that had been delayed. Here's more of what he said.
We are in a position today to begin to pull back and lean in by beginning to schedule surgeries once again throughout not only our hospital system, but our broader healthcare delivery system.
The health and medicine reporter for The Washington Post, Lenny Bernstein, has been writing about this transition in more states than California, and he's joining us again by phone. Hi, Lenny. Glad to have you back on the program.
Hi, thanks for having me back again.
So California is not the first state to take this step. It is a transition, though, that has been starting across the country. How widely is it being practiced yet, or are we just at the turning point?
We're at the turning point. The plans are being made. Some are actually implementing it. It's hit and miss. Depends on how much COVID you have in your community, frankly. One of the more remarkable things about this epidemic, this pandemic, is that you can have a state like Pennsylvania, which has a relatively high number of cases, I believe it's top five, and yet you have a community like Pittsburgh with very little COVID, very little COVID. They're using something like 6 or 7% of their ventilators, 6 or 7% of the people in their ICU have COVID. So what they are starting to do is to take another part of their health system far away from where the COVID folks are and beginning to offer some electable procedures.
So you're right. When I look at the NCOV 2019, it's New York and New Jersey still at the top with Massachusetts, and then Pennsylvania just ahead of California. So I think that it's a hospital by hospital decision, isn't it? More than any other statewide or local directive?
It is. It's up to, once you meet certain criteria, it's up to the hospital, it's up to the local officials, state officials. But yes, and that makes sense, right? You have to be able to test people as they come in, and so your hospital, your medical center has to have that capability, although it's very hard to get equipment in order to provide these tests to make sure that nobody's bringing COVID into your hospital. And then if you can do that and perform these elective procedures safely, then you can go ahead and do it. And, of course, what we're not saying here is these hospitals desperately need these procedures to generate revenue.
Right.
This is where they make their money, in the people who come in not through the ER and not as walk-ins. The scheduled services are where the money is made that balances out all the costs of those other folks.
So a lot of the attention is on medical services. What about dental? Is that conversation happening yet?
I don't think it's happening much, to be perfectly honest. It's, you know, the dentist has to get very close up to the person. The testing isn't really available to dentists yet. And so even if a dentist were to be covered in PPE and really take strong action to protect themselves, I don't see that we're going to see that come back before things like certain heart procedures, certain cancer surgeries that have been delayed, certain kinds of gastrointestinal scoping that have been delayed. Those are, while not emergencies, they are more urgent than dentistry. Now, of course, if you have a toothache that has become, you know, an abscess or is something you just simply can't live with, they're going to have to figure out a way to do that for you.
Meanwhile, I'm seeing more stories today about nursing homes just pleading for more testing, and nursing homes, of course, being the site of many cluster outbreaks and such a frightening location for people and for families. So are you expecting that nursing homes are going to get priority attention across the country for testing? And with that, where is your reporting going next?
Well, they may. it's very difficult. Nursing homes combine the worst aspects in terms of vulnerability that COVID has brought us. They are places where people live in close contact, where the care providers have to feed them, clean them, and so actually touch them, so you can't have the 6 foot of distance that you would like to have. And older people are much, much more vulnerable to the virus. So here we have the perfect place for the virus to spread, the perfect place for the virus to do its worst damage. I think that, you know, what you're going to see is continued cluster outbreaks in the United States in places like nursing homes, prisons, other kinds of adult facilities. It's why it's going to be very difficult for colleges to reopen in the fall, because all these kids are, you know, going to be living on top of each other in dorms if they do. I think that is a very difficult problem for us going forward until we just have massive ability to test constantly and accurately.
So when California's governor says our goal is 60 to 80,000 tests per day relatively soon, with a capacity in the system for 95,000 tests per day, in terms of all the states and the numbers you're hearing, how does that measure up?
What have you got there, 40 million people in California?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, 90,000 is great. That's a large number. But think of yourself going back into the office. Will you be comfortable being even 6 feet away from somebody, even if they give us all masks, even if we are able to find some form of social distancing that really works? Will you be comfortable sitting there all day, 8-10 hours a day, working in your cubicle or even in your office without knowing that the closest person is negative? That's the equation. Everything going forward is going to be about risk management. Is this safe enough for me to undertake it, to go into the workplace, to go into the nursing home, to go into the hospital, to go to the movies, to go to that park, to go to that beach? We're going to be making those calculations for a long time going forward. 90,000 tests is wonderful, but I can't do the math fast enough in my head, a tiny fraction of what you need in a state of 40 million.
Well, I think you just gave us the best exercise, and that is to think on our own level about our own lives and what risk we're willing to take, what situation we're willing to be in going forward. And it changes every day, doesn't it, Lenny? Every day.
It's going to change every day. And, you know, it's going to get better as we have more and more and more serological tests available to us that will tell us who has the antibody. As we learn whether antibodies means permanent immunity to this virus or means temporary immunity to this virus, as we figure out new ways to arrange our lives, taking people, let's say, in their 60s or with underlying comorbidities and putting them someplace in the office where they are less likely to be exposed. We're going to be doing all of this in our lives between now and the development of a reliable treatment, or even better, a reliable vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we're going. That's the bridge from where we are now to there.
All right, Lenny, take care. You and I will have many more conversations between now and then. So thanks for joining
us. Absolutely. Anytime you need me.
All right, you take care. Lenny Bernstein is health and medicine reporter for The Washington Post. Governor Gavin Newsom holds another press conference today. Cap Radio will carry this live at noon. By the way, if you saw the news about two cats in New York testing positive for COVID-19, you might want to listen to Insight from April 7th. I talked with the Sacramento Zoo's head veterinarian, Dr. Janessa Jeltema, and UC Davis small animal expert, Dr. Jane Sykes. They provided some very good science and good guidance. And that was, again, April 7th. Up next, we're going to get to some of the many, many questions about filing unemployment benefits and claims. We'll try to get some of your questions answered. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.